Welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone. I'm the officer of the deck today. We've got some great programs for you. I think you'll find very interesting. We always want to remind you, you can find more about Veterans Radio at its Facebook site or by going to veteransradio.net, where we're on the web 24/7. You can find a lot of our podcasts there as well. We post new ones every Tuesday, so you can get a new story, a new interview, something you didn't know before by going to veteransradio.net. And before we get started, we want to thank our sponsors. First up, we want to thank National Veteran Business Development Council, NVBDC.org. It was established to certify both service-disabled and veteran-owned businesses in the government and commercial or corporate marketplace. You'll find out how they can help your business by going to nvbdc.org. We also want to thank Eisenhower Center. It's a brain injury recovery center, and in particular, it's after the impact program goes beyond awareness campaigns and state-of-the-art imaging to help veterans, first responders, and athletes. Learn more about EisenhowerCenter.com. They're located in Michigan and in Florida. And finally, we want to thank Legal Help for Veterans. Legal Help for Veterans fights for veterans' disability rights all across the nation. You can reach them at 800-693-4800 or on the web at legalhelpforveterans.com. And finally, we want to welcome a new sponsor to the program, which is Veterans Business Outreach Center, which is located in Flint, Michigan, and covers Michigan, Ohio, and Indiana. The center is ran and operated by veterans to help other veterans, National Guard, Reserve, spouses, expand and grow businesses. You can find more about them by going to vetbizcentral.org, 810-252-6200. And now on to our programs. We want to welcome to Veterans Radio Lieutenant Commander Reuben Keith Green of the United States Navy, retired. Commander, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you, Jim. Happy to be here.
Well, we're always thrilled to have a Navy vet here talking about his experiences. You have a unique set of experiences, having gone from enlisted to officer in the Navy, which is never easy to do in any service, and particularly challenging here as you moved from an African-American who enlisted for different reasons, but then joined up, got into the officer corps after a number of years and really got a chance to see the world. So we're going to cover the waterfront, as I should say. So we're glad to have you on, Reuben.
Thank you.
So let's talk about why a kid at 17 years old down in Florida decides, maybe even against parental advice, I'm going to go into the military and I'm going to join the Navy.
Well, because I was headed nowhere and I was going there fast, I decided that if I stayed in the little small town of Tarpon Springs, Florida, largely segregated, there wasn't much of a future there for me. It didn't matter really how smart I was or anything else. It was just my path was pretty well laid out just based on, cultural demographics and stuff. So I decided to join the Navy against my father's wishes, because whenever he talked about the Navy with his buddies and stuff, he always seemed to be animated about it. Occasionally there would be some bad stories that came up, but I think he really enjoyed his time in the Navy. He just had some issues with certain things.
Well, and you, your family has a history of service, your grandfather, your father, you, brothers. So there is a family of service in the Green history tree, isn't there?
There's about 100 years.
And I think that's important for people to know that you're bringing that perspective to it and maybe have some advice that maybe you wish somebody would have passed on to you. And maybe this interview will let you do that. Now, you got out of high school, but didn't graduate, if I understand it right.
Right. I quit 3 years, weeks into my senior year and joined the Navy.
So the reason I want to point this out is because you're going to hear in this interview how far he's gone, and he is the author of a book that we're going to talk about. And so it's one of those things where that whole educational and growing up process, you really did it in the Navy, didn't you?
Absolutely. I got my high school diploma my first year in the Navy through the pre-discharge education program in Charleston, South Carolina. And then while I was stationed in Cuba, I was the discipline yeoman for the naval station down there. I completed a bunch of coursework and took some CLEP exams, and I got my associate's degree. And then when I transferred to Jacksonville in 1980, I completed my bachelor's degree requirements and got my bachelor's degree. And that's when I applied for OCS and went to the officer candidate school.
And Commander Green here published a couple of years back and has, you can find it on all your favorite booksellers, a very interesting book called Black Officer, White Navy, Thriving While Black and Sailing Second Class in the Post-Zumwalt Navy. And we're going to talk about that a little bit, but before we get there, Commander, talk about some of your overseas duty assignments, which I think would make everybody envious that they didn't get such great assignments.
Well, I graduated from Mine Manet School in Charleston, South Carolina in 1975. And then after a brief hiatus into the reserves, I came back to Charleston, and they almost immediately sent me to Sigonella, Sicily, to be the detachment yeoman. I was a mineman, but they figured out I could type, so, and they were short on minemen, so I went to be the detachment yeoman. I spent 6 months in Sicily. And made a couple trips around, I went to Naples once and knocked around in Sicily a little bit. And I came back to Charleston, and then just a few months later, they sent me to Glen Douglas, Scotland, the NATO ammunition depot there on the in Scotland. So I lived in a little town called Helensburgh, but we worked at a NATO ammunition depot. After I left there, I was back to Charleston for a short while, and then I had converted from a mineman to a yeoman, and then they sent me to legal clerk school in Newport, Rhode Island, and then I was assigned as the mast yeoman in Guantanamo Bay for 2 years and 4 days. Remember exactly how long you serve in Guantanamo. And after that, I was stationed in Mayport. I volunteered for the Navy's Equal Opportunity Program Specialist program. The minimum requirement was E6, but I got a waiver to go as an E5 because they really needed people for those billets. And after a few years in Mayport, once I got commissioned, I was stationed on a frigate out of Mayport. We did a lot of drug interdiction stuff down in the Caribbean, lots of Caribbean port visits and what have you. And then when I became chief engineer on an FFG, a frigate, I made a Persian Gulf cruise to Persian Gulf. When I left that job, I got assigned as the executive officer on the Navy hydrofoil stationed down in Key West. We did a lot of interdiction, a lot of port visits, a lot of dog and pony shows every time we pulled into port because all the dignitaries wanted to fly in a Navy hydrofoil. So we were very accommodating with that. Good PR for the Navy. And it was good visibility for the Navy.
And this is a career that's spanned from 1975 until April 1st of 1997. And during that period, I mean, it's really amazing the different places you got to see and I'm sure the broadening of your perspective. You really are clearly an avid reader from reading your book. I know you're an avid reader and a pretty prolific and well writer, as you look back and think about that 17 or 19 year old kid who just was getting into the Navy, did you ever think this is where you'd be?
Not at all. When I dropped out of high school, I had always been a prolific reader. I was reading at a 2-year college level, but I was flunking English because in my mind, the dead end Florida school system at that time didn't present very many opportunities for me. There was no way with my grades that I was going to get a scholarship or anything like that. So joining the Navy was a logical choice for me. I didn't want to join the Army or the Marines. So, I just followed in my father's footsteps. But no, I had always been very interested in reading. Reading is what got me to where I wound up today. Because if you don't read, you really can't learn that much.
Well, and it was important in, you know, every promotion, you've got to study and get there, and every, you know, taking school remotely, and kids today, your version of remote learning is much different than the commanders in mine, because when you were on ship, the box showed up and you had stuff to fill out and mail back. It was an internet remote learning. So you had a very, you had a proclivity to do this, and you had the opportunity to do this because, again, some of these Navy assignments allow you to have time to focus on improving yourself, don't they?
That's a fact. And I was willing to sacrifice a lot of sleep in order to learn stuff that I needed that would help me get promoted. My main goal when I joined the Navy, when I decided I was going to try to become an officer, was to command my own ship. And there's a lot of reading and a lot of learning that has to take place before you're ready for a job like that.
And anybody of a certain age, again, if you're too computer literate, you won't appreciate this, but your discussion of celestial navigation made me break into cold sweats again from doing it myself. It was a horrible section of the book to read, but it brought back those memories of celestial navigation. Oh boy, that's a tough one.
I just started to sweat when you brought it up.
So let me go back, though, because I want to talk about the book, and I want to talk about the experiences. While there's a whole batch of great experiences that you had being in the Navy, being an African American in the late 70s through the 80s into the 90s in the Navy was not a piece of cake. And one line that I made a note of that you wrote, you said the daily indignities that minority sailors and officers had to endure. And it really was that, and the book explains a lot of that. But Commander, talk to us a little bit about how those experiences came in, day out, but ultimately didn't stop you from doing what you wanted to accomplish.
Well, if you grow up in the South, as a lot of enlistees do, especially, minority sailors, the South contributes, Georgia contributes more military members than any other state in the Union. But if you grow up in the South, you learn quite early to both to adjust to and anticipate some of those responses. And I always viewed any sort of overt or covert hostility or disrespect or whatever as a challenge. I would make it my point to outperform or outshine the people that were trying to diminish me, because I knew at some level that it stemmed from either fear or jealousy. So my goal was to rise above all that and to just run circles around the people that were trying to diminish me. At some level, at some point, they begin to respect you because of that. But there is a toll that takes on you, both psychologically and emotionally, having to fight that battle constantly.
Yeah, I wanted you to expand on the idea that as a black sailor, you'd run into this problem where you would not get recognized for exceptional work that's being done.
Well, you know, that started early in my career, and it was quite a shock to me because I thought my father was wrong, and I learned very early that he was right. I thought that when Admiral Zumwalt said that there was no black Navy, no white Navy, there was just one Navy, everyone would hand salute, and that's what would happen. I joined the Navy 6 months after Admiral Zumwalt retired, and when I went to Mimon A School, there were 25 people that started that class, and only seven of us graduated. I was the number two graduate in the class. And David Badger, excuse me, David Badger, the class genius, graduated number one. He has photographic memory. He emailed me after he read the book 20 years after I'd last seen him, that told me what my exact GPA was. So, but he was aware. They lowered my grades from being honor roll eligible. And then they told me I wasn't eligible for promotion. And it was the weekly indignities I had to endure at at personnel inspections and during practical examinations, they made it quite clear that I wasn't welcome, even though I was outperforming, you know, 20, 25 or 26 other people.
And I think it's easy sometimes to think, well, they're just picking on me because they're, you know, and indeed, certainly the younger enlisted guys all get picked on. But this was not that. This was sort of a systematic, we don't want this black sailor to get too far advanced. That's really the message they were sending you, wasn't it?
That is exactly correct.
And let me again remind our veteran radio listeners, we're talking to Lieutenant Commander Reuben Keith Green. So it didn't work what they were trying to do.
Not at all.
I told Reuben before we got started that my problem in reading this book is about every page I had to stop and write down another book that he referenced or some history that he referenced that I wanted to go read about. Talk to us why it was important, Commander, for you to write this naval history of minority service so embedded into your book, Black Officer, White Navy, Thriving While Black and Sailing Second Class in the Post-Zumwalt Navy.
Well, I thought it was important that any individual has their own story, but I thought it was important to wrap what was happening in the country around my particular story. For instance, the instance where I was preparing to go to sea, the Persian Gulf deployment, and my supply officer was denying me the resources I needed to prepare the ship. That was going to have an impact on the, if my ship didn't deploy on time, that was going to have an impact much beyond just my particular ship not deploying. Other ships might have to, schedules might have to be adjusted. The captain was going to get hammered. I mean, there was a domino effect. And I compare that to the problems that black farmers were having in the 1980s during the same time period where they were being denied resources in order to properly farm. And it was specifically black farmers. So I wanted to show both the on the ground view and then the 10,000 foot view of what was happening in the larger country. I kept trying to tie what was happening to me and what was happening in the Navy to events that were happening throughout the nation, both political and economic and cultural.
And one of the things that I think you do a great job of in the book is talking about Admiral Zumwalt and what his goal was and how far short we were coming in it in the Navy at that point. Can you talk about your, if I dare say, admiration for the Admiral? And where you think if we had followed his directions, we might be better off?
Well, you call it admiration. I prefer the term reverence. he's a real hero to me. And he literally had to be educated by his minority affairs assistant, Lieutenant Commander William S. Norman, who had put in a resignation letter because he was so disgusted with the Navy and their lack of progress. He'd been on all of the boards and committees and recommendations, and he'd had his own experiences similar to mine. And Admiral Zumwalt said, bring this guy in. I want to talk to him before he retires. And Lieutenant Commander Norman walked in there with a list of 20s. Basically, there were 20 recommendations, but they really were demands. Zumwalt said that I called him in to interview him, and it turns out he was interviewing me. But those two together worked to identify and eliminate all of the institutional biases that existed in the Navy and obstacles. It wasn't until Norman pointed it out to Zumwalt that Filipino sailors could only serve in the stewards branch, and Zumwalt immediately changed that. So that one point changed the course of the career of many, many Filipino sailors. That's just one example. So I admire the man greatly. The problem with Zumwalt in his era was that much of the civilian leadership did not like what he was doing, and there were very powerful Southern politicians, including John C. Stennis. And there's a story in the book where when the some of the black sailors on some of the ships had begun to protest their treatment and do sit-down, work stoppages, et cetera, Henry Kissinger called Zumwalt, told him, the president wants you to immediately discharge those sailors with a dishonorable discharge. Of course, Richard Nixon knew that wasn't possible. He's a former naval officer himself. But that was just the law and order type approach that the government was taking towards those sorts of issues. And then when Senator John C. Stennis got wind of that, he wanted to blame it all on Zumwalt, saying he had created a climate of permissiveness. And along with former CNO George Anderson and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Admiral Thomas Moorer, who was a racist from Alabama, there was a lot of pushback to what Zumwalt was trying to do. And the admiral's lobby, both retired and active duty, were to a large extent aligned against him, because the Navy had almost no black officers, like 0.5%, and they didn't want any.
No, and again, the history that's involved in the book is really well done and eye-opening. I did want to come back to maybe three pearls of wisdom that you have here, too, so that you can talk to the broader audience and maybe some of the young men and women who may listen to this. Talk about the importance of mentorship, both in your situation, but in everybody's situation as you try to advance.
If you don't have a good mentor, you are going to make a lot of mistakes. I had people that looked out for me, and they were almost all white because just by the rank demographics. The only time I worked for a black man, I worked for two black men in the Navy, and that was early on in my career. And one of them had turned down a commission, and he told me, he said, "Keith, if you want to make any changes, you need to get some gold on your shoulders. That's where you're going to be able to make some changes." So mentorship is important, but what's even more important is having a sponsor, which is someone with some power that can help guide your career and look out for you if you happen to run into any trouble. Well, so the sponsors are as important as the mentor. For my career, I had people that looked out for me multiple occasions. One of my heroes is Master Chief Daniel J. Zapiro. He saved me from a vindictive Master Chief that was trying to destroy my career by fabricating these negative critiques and whatnot. And Dan Zapiro is a true hero to me. He really did save me.
Well, that's, again, these are the, you know, hard-earned lessons that you want to pass on to people, is look for those mentors and those sponsors. But you also talk about, and this is shouldn't be surprising to somebody who writes so well and who was a, you know, sort of accidental yeoman and legal professional here, the power of documentation. I think, again, that's something that is a lesson you learn over time, and maybe you can pass it along.
That is one of the most important things I learned in the Navy. It doesn't matter what you say. It is only what you can prove. If you can't prove that you're being discriminated against, it can be happening on a regular basis, but you need to have proof. And you also need documentation to prove that you're right. A lot of times you will bring up an issue and you may have a gut feeling that something needs to be done or something shouldn't be done, but you have to be able to document it, because, I mean, the military operates on numbers. The numbers are critical, whether you're a supply officer or a weaponeer or an engineer. You have to stay within those parameters in terms of, you know, doing your job. And if something falls outside those parameters, and number one, you haven't paid attention to it, or you haven't documented, a ton of bricks can fall down on your head. But it's very important to document what is happening to you in your career and what's going on around you. I made a point of every time, not every time, but often when I would go see one of my bosses, especially after I got my commission, I'd see one of my bosses about something, and I would just casually ask, "Is there anything that I'm doing that you don't want me to do? Is there anything that I'm not doing that you want me to do?" And whatever that was, I would write it down, because I didn't want any surprises when it was time for my fitness report. So if it was something I needed to change, I would jump on it immediately. And if everything was going well, I'd look for ways to improve.
Well, and there's one more that I want to use, and then we'll shift into some of your more recent writings. And in Black Officer, White Navy, you talk about the power of words and symbols. Can you elaborate a little bit about that, Commander?
Oh, I certainly can. Going back to the first 6 months I was in the Navy, there was a young man at one of the school's commands there in Charleston, South Carolina, who had filed a discrimination complaint. He was facing the same kind of discrimination I was. I never met him, but I know what was happening. You got to remember, Charleston is where the first shots of the Civil War were fired. Admiral Thomas Crow said that when he was stationed there, he never met anybody in South Carolina that thought the South had lost the Civil War. You know, so my buddy and I were walking down the sidewalk in front of the school, and this pickup truck pulls up in front of us, and it's the captain of the school. And he tells us to get in. He wants to give us a ride. Well, of course, the hair on the back of my neck stood up because this guy had never paid any attention to us at all. So we got into his truck, and plastered all across the dashboard were stickers honoring the Confederacy. Forget hell, the South's going to rise again, et cetera, et cetera. And I was terrified. I literally was worried that something was about to happen to me. I looked in the rearview mirror to see if there was a car behind us. That symbology for a person raised in the South can be quite powerful. So I spent almost all of my career in the South, and seeing Confederate flags and those types of stickers all over the base and in people's offices was not an unusual occurrence. But it has an ability to be intimidating to minorities.
Well, and I think it's just good advice for everybody, right, to think a little bit about, hey, what you say and the symbols you use has a certain amount of power, intended or unintended. And you may have to decide for yourself whether it's a good intention or a bad, but don't overlook the power of words and symbols. And I think that's really driven home in your book. And again, I really recommend it to folks. They can find it on any of your booksellers, your online sellers. It's also in ebook version. Lieutenant Commander Reuben Keith Green, you did a great job.
Thank you.
I'd like to turn, if I can, to sort of some things that are going on more recently, while the book is really capturing that period of time during your service from 1975 to 1997. Here we sit in 2020, and the country again finds itself evaluating, talking about, arguing about symbols and the case for renaming forts and bases and ships. And you've written on two articles I want to talk about, one in the United States Navy Institute magazine in 2020 of June, the case for renaming the USS John C. Stennis. Talk to us about what motivated you to write this, Commander, and a little bit about why and how you wrote it.
Well, it always galled me to think that the man who did so much to try to derail the changes in the Navy that allowed me to become an officer was honored with an aircraft carrier. And I had read Zumwalt's memoir that talked about Stennis's efforts to derail his trying to bring the Navy into the 21st century. And then when I read about Stennis's background, as a prosecutor in Mississippi, where he was complicit in trying to execute three black men who had been convicted based on confessions obtained via torture, I just found it appalling. And so for me, that was something. If you're talking about removing symbols that divide, I just could not imagine myself being assigned to a ship that was named in honor of someone with a background like that. I mean, just think about that. It's Black History Month, and, you know, you've got these, you know, Black History Month celebrations going on, and you've got, you know, potentially these white sailors saying, hey, you know, Stennis was a diehard racist, right? You know, I mean, that would be something. Every day you walk aboard that ship and you hear John C. Stennis arriving, it's just a constant reminder that you're serving on a ship named for an ardent segregationist who rode his defeat by the Supreme Court and his ability to execute those men, rode that into a career as a prosecutor and a judge and then a Mississippi State Senator. And I think that sends a wrong signal in the 21st century when you're talking about inclusion and diversity. It's like a constant slap in the face.
And it's really interesting as we go through this debate about different forts and different ships, the naming of it, you know, you wonder who the heck did what vetting on these names, or what other political pressures were involved in putting the name forward and skipping over all of the maybe the bad history, if you will. And did you find that was what was really involved in the Stennis, is those sort of outside forces in the naming?
Well, Ronald Reagan was an ardent admirer of John C. Stennis. Stennis did a lot for the Navy. I believe that based on some of the recordings that came out after the fact, that Ronald Reagan may have been sympathetic to Stennis's racial views. So he was willing to overlook all of that and honor the man who was quite powerful in the South. And I don't know if Ronald Reagan said he wanted something, he was going to get it. They kept taking that "tear down this wall" line out of his speech, where he told Gorbachev to tear down that wall, and he kept putting it back in, and he did utter it. So I think he was a strong-willed personality, and I'm not sure what he thought about Zumwalt, but he was an ardent admirer and was full of respect for John Stennis. Yeah. I don't have the background on the, you know, what went into that.
A little more timely naming, and I think one we ought to talk about, is the USS Doris Miller. You tell folks to look it up, as you do in a lot of your writing. You sort of tease them with it and say, now go do some research of your own.
That's
but,
right.
But let's go ahead and tell Doris Miller's story, because I think it was avoided or ignored or forgotten for so long.
Well, when he was serving in Pearl Harbor, I forget which ship exactly, but he was trained as an ammunition loader. But once the Pearl Harbor attack began, his captain was severely injured. He helped get his captain to safety, and then he went back up and he operated this machine gun, which he had not been trained to operate, and shot at multiple Japanese planes. There's no documentation that he ever shot any down. But he was one of the last three men to leave the ship as it was sinking. And he helped, you know, save a lot of people on that ship. Now, when the initial press reports came out, they just said an unnamed black sailor had done all these things. And so the black press began pushing to have the sailor recognized. He got a lower award than some of the other awardees on the ship. But they began to use Doris Miller as a recruiting tool. And he wound up getting transferred to another ship after his recruiting journey across the United States, and was lost at sea when the other ship he was on sunk. I learned a lot more about this story when I read a book called Black Men in Blue Water by Chester Wright, who knew Doris Miller and some of the people that knew him. So there are many, many gems in that book. It's not a well-known book, but it's a great reference if you want to know what the Navy was like for black sailors prior to, you know, the early 70s.
Well, and you make another suggestion in this article on the replacement name for the Stennis. Let's remove his name. Tell us who you think it ought to be named for.
Well, the man that Admiral Zumwalt, who is credited with bringing the Navy into the 21st century and who received the Presidential Medal of Freedom from President Bill Clinton, you can watch that clip on YouTube. He said that William S. Norman, his minority affairs assistant, did more than any person on the planet to improve the plight of black sailors in the Navy. I find it amazing that Lieutenant Commander Norman's records are not in the distinguished veteran section of the National Archives. Dennis Denmark Nelson, who was one of the Golden 13 and wrote the book, The Integration of the Negro into the United States Navy, his records are there. But William Norman is one of those overlooked heroes that without him educating Zumwalt and teaching him how things were for minority sailors and their families, many of these changes may not have taken place for decades.
And these are the kind of stories I think it's so important to tell down through history so that they don't get lost, and that young men and women coming up, whatever they're facing, in your book you talk about issues for gays and blacks and Hispanics, but whatever issue you're facing, you can look at these guys, these stories you're telling us, and realize there's hope, that one man, one woman can make a difference in the right situation, don't you?
Absolutely. You have to believe that change is possible. And once you believe that, then you have to start looking for ways to make it happen.
Just in August of 2020, you wrote an article called The Navy's Perpetual Racism Problem and How to Fix It for the Center for International Maritime Security. And I want to ask you a couple of questions. I think you right up front point out three problems. First is there's racism in the ranks. Second is that's a failure of leadership. And third, it's the Navy's unwilling to face head on the first two problems. And what I want to have you expand on a little bit is your suggestion that what the Navy needs to do is to target the problem as though it were an operational necessity and matter of national security to fix. What were you thinking about as you wrote that?
Well, I compare it to a captain who runs his ship aground. When a captain runs his ship aground, whether it's a soft grounding or hard grounding, he doesn't get to select the officer that's going to investigate whether he did anything wrong or whether the ship was well-trained, et cetera. Someone outside of that organization takes a full court press looking at all of the training, the past history, the material condition, et cetera. What were the circumstances? They do an all-encompassing look to see what contributed to that. Now, when someone is accused of racism, the captain selects someone to do that investigation, and that person knows that the captain is going to sign his fitness report at the end of the reporting period. So there's a conflict of interest there. The other thing is the Navy has equal opportunity program personnel assigned to many major large commands, some as a collateral duty, and the captain also signs their fitness report. But what is interesting is that the person who has the most knowledge and the most training can only make an advisory opinion, which is very often overridden. There was an article that came out, a special report in Reuters just last week, and it talked about the high barrier that minority sailors face when trying to report discrimination in the Navy. And between 1987 and 1991, the average substantiated discrimination complaint number percentage for the Navy was 7%. According to this article, in 2019, the average substantiated rate was 6%. So it's actually dropped. All these decades later. The problem is people really don't understand how pervasive racism is. So what they perceive as just normal everyday behavior is microaggressions and sabotage or whatever. But, you know, the Navy really needs to revamp, and not just the Navy, the Department of Defense. I've been fighting for 2 years to get some of those statistics released to me. And so far, they've been unwilling to do it.
As you look back over your long career, and you can go back 100 years because you can go through your father's and your grandfather's service, and as you project forward as a deep thinker on this issue, is the Navy heading in the right direction? I mean, it's incrementally slow, but are we at least making progress? What's your prognosis here, Commander?
I think we're headed in the right direction, but, you know, once again, it all comes back to leadership. If the leadership is committed to fixing a problem, it'll happen. Apollo 13, you know, that those people back there at Houston said failure is not an option. And as far as I'm concerned, if you've got 40% of the Navy comprised of military personnel, continuing to accept the status quo is not an option, because We had significant racial incidents all over the military back in the 60s, 70s, and on through the 80s. You don't hear about a lot of those because it's kind of hushed up. But people are getting tired and people are getting frustrated because you can't use the system to help protect yourself and hold people accountable. Well, people eventually are going to start going outside the system. On more than one occasion, I had to use unorthodox methods to make my point and to protect myself.
And really, it's if you're, you know, you've had a great career. Again, we talked about this earlier, that you don't regret having committed your adult life to the Navy.
Oh, absolutely. I would recommend anyone join the military. What I regret is the system that I trusted to protect me. You know, they teach you to fight, but then when you fight for yourself, the wagons get circled around the perpetrator as opposed to the victim. That has been my experience, and that's been reported to me from many other people. So the system has to change and recognize that when you protect someone who is behaving in a racist manner, you are undermining the stability of that organization. And when people vote with their feet, you're cutting off your nose to spite your face. Because as people begin to spread those messages about, the Navy had a terrible reputation in the 40s and 50s. People were actively telling people not to join the Navy. So if that message gets out there again, then you're eliminating a large portion of your recruiting pool.
And you are causing that recruiting pool not to have the opportunity to have this great career. I mean, this country should be giving people equal opportunity to succeed, and we shouldn't let those kind of viewpoints and processes say, well, you can't go to Sicily, you can't go to Scotland, you can't, you know. So there's a real push and pull here, and a need for people to say, I'm going to get through this, and I'm going to prove my worth. And you've certainly done it, Commander. As I say, it's a great story. I know you have a website, and you're continuing to write things. Why don't you tell our Veteran Radio listeners a little bit about how they can find you and how they can communicate with you?
Well, I have a rudimentary website at RubenKeithGreen.com. I'm not on any other social media, but I am on LinkedIn, Reuben Green, writer looking for minority veteran stories. One of my goals is to write a book about the experiences of African-Americans and minorities from various branches of the service, because mine is just one story. That's one data point. If you get enough people sharing their stories, people don't know this, but there are very few, you can count on one hand, the stories and books written about the Vietnam War era. On one hand, you can count those by authors of African-American ancestry. And two of those are fictionalized versions that were written by people that never served. So there's a big hole in the literature about the experiences of African-American service people after the Vietnam War era. And I'm trying to do my best to fix that.
Well, we appreciate all that you've done and you continue to do on behalf of the military, the Navy, the African-American community, and getting this history preserved and out so that it can influence policymakers and just regular individuals going forward. And Lieutenant Commander Reuben Keith Green, thanks for spending some time today with Veterans Radio.
Thank you, and I really appreciate the opportunity.
And I want to thank everybody for listening to Veterans Radio today. I am Jim Fossone. It's been a pleasure to be your host. I'm a veterans disability lawyer at Legal Help for Veterans, and you can reach us at 800-693-4800 or legalhelpforveterans.com on the web. You can follow Veterans Radio on Facebook and listen to its podcasts and internet radio shows by going to veteransradio.net. And until next time, you are dismissed.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
Veterans Radio needs you. If you like our shows that are informative, surprising stories, and relevant information on what's happening at the VA and the military, we'd like your support. Individual support of $5 to $50 a month or corporate sponsorship of $1,000 to $10,000 would be welcomed. You can go to veteransradio.net, click on the sponsorship or support tab, pay online, and keep Veterans Radio on the air.